France braces for its 11th day of strikes. Live from the BBC World Service, this is the Marketplace Morning Report. I'm Leanna Byrne. France is facing another day of strikes and protests today after talks between trade unions and the Prime Minister Elizabeth Borne failed to make progress. Unions say she refused to discuss rolling back legislation raising the retirement age from 62 to 64. Striking French train driver Axel Pearson said protesters want to make France ungovernable.
Well, it's not much about changing the government's mind because we won't convince each other. This is a confrontation between organized labor, between the population in general, and the employers of the government. What we aim to achieve through these continued protests, strikes, industrial action, and so forth, is to make the country as ungovernable as possible, in order to force the employers to call down, to call the government and tell them just to scrap this law because it just isn't worth it. We won't convince each other. The government is bent on basically stealing 2 years of our pensions, and we are determined to fight them. But if we continue to organize strikes, industrial actions, and inflict enough political, social, and economical damage on the employers and the government, in the end, we will prevail. And that is how it has always happened in the past when we've managed to defend our interests.
For many, 64 sounds like a normal age for retirement. Many countries have a higher legal age of retirement. What is your objection to this 2 years?
Well, there are countries who have lower in retirement age. That's also a fact. There are countries who have higher. But the thing is, our adversaries, they find the principle of retirement as a political heresy because what is it in fact? It is to pay people to be doing nothing. So that is something that just does not fit into their mind. So it will never be something that is profitable. The retirement will always be too low. We as workers, our interest is to lower the pension age, is to lower the working hours, and it's to have more free time to enjoy the fruits of our labor, to have more free time to enjoy our family, our kids, and for leisure. And they want to do the exact opposite. They want us to force us into as many working hours a week at their disposal, and at the same time force us to be at their disposal for as long as possible across our entire life. And we won't accept that.
French train driver Axel Pearson there. Now to Argentina. Thousands of people have been protesting there against cuts in spending imposed as part of a $44 billion debt repayment deal with the International Monetary Fund. Cost of living in the country has doubled since the start of the year. Our America's editor Mimi Swaby reports.
In the capital, Buenos Aires, traffic has been brought to a standstill by more than 100 roadblocks set up by demonstrators. Disruption has been reported in 135 cities, and the Pan-American Highway has been blocked in both directions. Although the International Monetary Fund has eased economic targets in its latest debt repayment deal with Argentina, many people are still not happy. Some critics fear the agreement is overly optimistic and is setting the country up for more economic failure. Argentina, the IMF's biggest debtor, has long battled with high inflation, but the rising cost of living and severe droughts has further destabilised its economy. This puts even more pressure on the government ahead of general elections in October.
Maybe Small will be reporting there. And now, let's do the numbers. The Credit Suisse fallout continues. The Swiss government is cancelling or cutting in half bonus payouts for its top executives as the company is taken over by UBS. And a mixed reaction to the US economic data. European stocks are edging higher while Asian stocks are down. And after 5 days on the up, oil prices have come down. One of the most important books in the history of English literature has gone on sale with a price tag of $7.5 million. It's a copy of the first Shakespeare folio, a collection of some of the most famous plays. It was printed 400 years ago in 1623, 7 years after the author's death. The BBC's Elizabeth Hodson went to find out more.
In the basement of a small bookshop in London's Mayfair sits one of the world's most valuable books. Without it, some of Shakespeare's most famous works would have been lost forever, according to Adam Douglas, the senior specialist in rare books at Peter Harrington, which is organising the sale.
It has 36 of his plays, half of which hadn't been published before. And we can be pretty certain that if they hadn't been published in this book, they would have been lost forever. That includes such big hits as Macbeth, All's Well That Ends Well, Twelfth Night. Two of his actor friends, who mentioned in his will, they had his original manuscripts and papers, so they were able to use those. Some of the plays, as I've mentioned, had been published, and they put them together in one volume.
One of my favourite Shakespeare plays is Macbeth, and it would be such a treat for me to sort of see this in pretty much its original form.
If you want Macbeth, this is the first printing of it. This is the first edition of Macbeth, and there you see the famous opening and the tragedy of Macbeth. Thunder and lightning enter three witches. When shall we three meet again, in thunder, lightning, or in rain? When the hurly-burly's done, when the battle's lost and won, that will be ere the set of sun, where the place upon the heath, there to meet with Macbeth.
Now, this isn't the only copy of the first folio in existence, so why is it so valuable? Who better to ask than Pom Harrington, the owner of the bookshop?
Copies come to market extremely rarely. In terms of importance and in English literature, this is number one. This is really the beginning of literature, creative writing, and we can argue about Chaucer, but this really is where it begins and is established. And so to any collector of rare books and literature, you want a first folio.
So what kind of buyer would be in the market for a $7.5 million book? Well, to give you an idea, Paul Allen, the Microsoft co-founder who died back in 2018, was one such deep-pocketed purchaser.
He bought one copy in 2001 for $5.6 million. That was a trophy piece. So I think you're talking that kind of person.
And with all the economic uncertainty, sometimes the old and familiar appeals to those with cash to spend.
When the banking crash happened last time in 2008, we sold two expensive books, I remember, on the crash day. And literally the decision was made, I'd rather have the tangible asset that I understand than money in the bank right now.
But if I had $7.5 million in the bank, would I spend it on a single book? Maybe, as long as I could afford the insurance policy. In London, I'm the BBC's Elizabeth Hodson for Marketplace.
Well, the hurly-burly's all done here at the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Leanna Byrne, and thank you for listening.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.